Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. I have Charlie with me today, so you can probably guess which direction we're going in, Charlie.
Oh, we are going back to the 17th century.
Surprise. Wonderful. Tell us why and who is here to talk to us.
Okay, well, today we have Frances Quinn with us. She's a journalist and now a novelist too. Her debut novel, The Smallest Man, was published by Simon & Schuster earlier this year to rave reviews, and she's very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about it today. Hello, Frances.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be brilliant. So we have had small mention of this man because we spoke to John Wolfe about freak shows, Victorian freak shows. He spoke to us a little bit about the history behind it, but we're actually going back to speak about Geoffrey Hudson. The Smallest Man is based around this real life character at the court of King Charles I. So who was Geoffrey Hudson and how much do we know about him?
So I should probably say first that the book is really inspired by Geoffrey Hudson. So Geoffrey Hudson doesn't actually appear in the novel. The main character in the novel is Nat Davy, who is based on Geoffrey Hudson. So Geoffrey Hudson, like a lot of characters that are sort of on the edge of history, we know bits and pieces of his story. So we know that he was born in Oakham, in Rutland. We know that he was presented to Queen Henrietta Maria in a pie. And what I found interesting is that obviously, you know, he was presented to her as a kind of human pet. She had other people with dwarfism at the court, and she had a kind of human animal menagerie with dwarfs and a giant and monkeys and dogs. But what was interesting about Geoffrey is that years later, when she went off to Holland to drum up arms and ammunition for the Civil War, he was still with her. So there was obviously more to the relationship between them than just this thing of him being a human pet. So we know that. We know he was there. We know he was there when she came under bombardment in Bridlington. We know he escaped with her to France. He was involved in a duel there. And then Geoffrey Hudson was captured by pirates and taken to Morocco as a slave. But that doesn't happen to Nat Davy.
Gosh. Writing the actual story of Geoffrey Hudson into a cohesive piece of historical fiction must have been a real challenge when he was so on the periphery. How did you decide what parts of his real story had to make it into this story of our fictional character, Nat Davy?
That was really probably one of the most difficult things, because, you know, when people read historical novels, they often do want to learn something. So you feel you can't veer too far away from the facts. And obviously, you know, you don't want a misleading background. But I couldn't put everything in. He has quite a long life. So I kind of chose the most dramatic elements. So he does get presented to the Queen in a pie. And then he basically has a ringside seat for her role in the Civil War, which I think is a part of Civil War history that we don't really hear much about. So through him, I was able to talk about what she was involved in doing because he was there beside her.
A historical novelist must be more at liberty to express their personal opinions in their writing. I noticed this, especially with your reading of Queen Henrietta Maria, who's still a divisive figure today. So what do you make of the Queen and her role at court?
She is such a fascinating person. So she comes over from France. She's a French princess. She's 15. Gosh. She gets married off to a bloke who's 10 years older than her and, by all accounts, not great with women. And they start off this absolutely horrendous marriage where, you know, they have arguments in public and there are evenings when he doesn't speak to her. There's one documented event where he basically writes to her and says, yeah, I will be sleeping with you because I've got a duty, but don't think it's because I fancy you or like you. It's just a port, you know, not in those words, but that was the import of the letter. And it just must have been horrendous. And then on the other side, she's got this pressure from the people that she's brought over with her that, you know, she's supposed to make things better for the Catholics, that the Pope's entrusted her with this sacred task, that the Catholics are persecuted. She is supposed to persuade the king to change the laws. So she's got them in one ear and then him being really horrible in the other ear, and then the Duke of Buckingham stirring the pot to keep everything bubbling. And she's 15 and she's homesick. She barely speaks any English. So this is how she starts. And then from there, she becomes this woman who was very, very involved in the Civil War struggle. She's the person, she goes off to Holland. She teaches herself or learns about arms and ammunition so that she can buy the right things for him. She brings them back. She comes under bombardment. There's this series of events where when she's finally got all the arms and ammunition, she comes back from Holland. They land at Bridlington. They come under bombardment in the middle of the night and have to shelter in a ditch in the snow all night long. And then they take these arms and ammunition down to Oxford, where the King's headquarters, and she basically leads the men. She sits outside with them, eats around the campfire, and she just becomes transformed into this incredible character. And I was really interested to know how that had happened, because I don't think that's really explained in the history books.
Gosh, do you think that's why she became so divisive? Because she was involved and, you know, and outspoken and Catholic?
Very much so. I mean, I think you see it sometimes with male leaders now. You know, almost the worst thing you can say about a president or a prime minister is, you know, the wife behind the throne. Look at Hillary Clinton when Bill was president.
Preach.
Well, how much of this is coming from her? And I think it's probably a similar thing that
Russian Express in World War One, anyone?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, because she was Catholic and Catholics were so hated, people were terrified that she was going to turn him Catholic. And then some of the things he did made them think that might be happening. So yeah, she was an incredible hate figure.
Gosh. I mean, aside from Henrietta Maria as a hate figure, there's another character that you've touched on very briefly who I thoroughly enjoyed meeting in your book, and that's the handsome George Villiers, the first Duke of Buckingham. Now,
yes.
It was interesting reading The Smallest Man, because in very quick succession I read three novels in which he popped up. Earthly Joys by Philippa Gregory, mm-hmm. The Honey and the Sting by Elizabeth Freemantle, and then of course The Smallest Man. How much fun was it researching him and bringing him to life?
He is a lot of fun. He is so awful. I think, I don't know, maybe we've all worked with someone a bit like him. I know I have. I worked with someone who was just awful, was just terrible at his job and lazy. And I remember this was in magazines, and we'd get a new editor and everyone would go, oh, she'll see through him. She'll realise. And they never did. And it was like this guy was casting spells on people. And I think Villiers is a bit like that. He seems to be able to charm the right people. I mean, he never bothered charming her, but he was charming Charles. He charmed Charles' father. Obviously there were allegations that they were in a sexual relationship, and yeah, I think he was just a guy who would do whatever it took to come out on top. And there was a point where half the country believed that actually he was in charge. It was funny because before they were accusing her of being the power behind the throne, they were accusing him. So poor old Charles, everybody thought he was being pushed around by just about anybody. And he probably was.
And it wasn't until Buckingham was assassinated. I don't think there's too much of a spoiler to say that on a history podcast. It wasn't until his assassination that the relationship between Charles and Henrietta Maria really changes for the better.
Exactly. And I thought that was really interesting. And again, I never found an explanation for that. I mean, it was obvious that once he was out of the picture, or until he was out of the picture, she didn't stand a chance. She wasn't going to be let in. But somehow she must have found a way to almost become for Charles what Buckingham had been. His sounding board, his guide, the person who said, oh, you're so clever, you're so marvellous. And somehow she did that. And so I had to think of a way that might have happened. And in the book, Nat Davey, the main character, is very involved in that. He's the one who gives her advice and says, try it this way, try that. And it works. And of course, we've got no way of knowing whether Geoffrey Hudson was secretly their marriage guidance counsellor, and I suspect not. But something happened there. Something made the change.
It's incredible when you start looking at the lives of these people at this time. There's always the slight litmus test on how a relationship's going, and the fact that there was no sniff of a pregnancy from Henrietta Maria until Buckingham's gone.
And apparently she was always claiming that it was a saint's day and it wasn't possible to sleep together. He complained at one point that there seemed to be a great many more saints' days than he ever thought there possibly could be. I suppose it's the 17th century equivalent of a headache.
Fantastic.
I think, would you say he's disabled? He's of different ability, isn't he? This is something that we don't see often in history books, is it? I think it's fair to say that disabled people have been marginalised in history, and we don't read about them and how their lives were and how they were perceived. Based on the books we read at the time and the bodice rippers we see on the screen, there's just no room for them, which is shocking. So I love that you've wanted to explore this sort of forgotten angle of history and talk about someone who was different. Did you find anything that surprised you when you were researching him?
I think what did surprise me was the friendship that obviously did grow up between them. I mean, as I say, we don't know the details of the relationship, but the fact that he was there over all those years. She didn't take any of the other dwarfs to Holland. She didn't take them when she escaped to France. So there must have been some kind of friendship and trust between them. So that surprised me. And then I guess sadly what surprised me was you would hope that things had changed a lot since then. And obviously researching the book, I got interested in dwarfism and how people with dwarfism are looked at these days. And there's a guy that I follow on Twitter, and he would often say that, you know, he'd be out walking down the street and people would video him. And that's what surprised me, that that's kind of the equivalent of Nat being a human pet in a way. That things really haven't changed as much as we would like to think. And that was one thing that I hope people will take from the book. I think if you have spent 300 odd pages in Nat's head, you might think twice. Maybe most people are not going to video people with dwarfism, but people will do the sideways look that they think isn't noticed. Oh, well, he's a dwarf. He must be used to people looking at him. Well, no one is. No one ever is. No one ever gets used to that. You're ruining their day. And I hope it might just make people think, oh, that's a bad idea.
I was at London Zoo with my friend's kid, and he was 3 at the time. And there was a chap there that had 2 artificial legs below the knee. And he was staring. And I said, Perry, don't look at him like that. It's not nice to stare at people who look different. And he said, but I want to know why he hasn't got any legs. And I said, well, perhaps you could ask him politely. And if he wants to tell you, he can, but he might not want to. And so he goes, March. I was like mortified. He goes, March, come. He goes, mister, why haven't you got any legs? And the man was with his family. God love him. He understood that it's like kids are kids. And he just said to him, oh, I had an accident, but it's okay because I've got new ones now. And he went, Taylor Bate, you look like a superhero. And then he stopped because he was done with the conversation. And I was just like, bless you, small child.
I think actually most, I mean, obviously you pick your moments, but I think most people with disabilities, my mum was also an amputee, and I know that she would have been totally fine with that.
Yeah,
that is much better than making a big deal of it, going, don't look at him. It's the sideways glance that I think
that's really don't like. Yeah. And
do
you know what else gets to me? We have a young chap who comes to Chelsea who is not only in a wheelchair but has breathing apparatus and everything. But his mum brings him to every single game. And I see people ask her how he is when he's there. That annoys me. I'm like, ask him. I will make a point of saying, how are you doing today, George?
Yeah, it's the classic, does he take sugar, isn't it?
He's not deaf. Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? And I think that's more offensive than someone outright coming out and asking you.
I think that's it. It's about sort of realizing, you know, this is what I wanted to show people with Nat, I suppose, is it doesn't matter what you look like on the outside. On the inside, we're pretty much all the same. We've all got the same thoughts. We can all be hurt. We all want the same things. And if anyone takes that away from the book, I'll be really happy.
Yeah. I think this is definitely applies to Charlie. When you say, because she has written down that the smallest man has the ultimate historical in the English Civil War. We know she lives and breathes it, aka the War of the Three Kingdoms, because she's going to be historically correct in her notes, because she's a girly swat. Tower Bar is Nat's story led by real events. When people open this, how much are they going to be carried through real events?
Well, Charlie, you're going to hate me for this. I really, really don't like the English Civil War. I studied it at school. I did it for A-level. And, you know, that will ruin you for any kind of history. That's
so funny, though. I studied it at A-level.
Oh,
and
I didn't
afterwards,
you.
I just couldn't. I just wanted to know what happened next and became obsessed. That's so funny.
You maybe had better teaching than I did. It just seemed to be this saga of politics and taxes. I don't think...
I cringe when I hear the words rump parliament.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Rump parliament and ship money. That was all that... the only two phrases I could remember. The Queen, I don't remember ever being mentioned. Maybe there was a vague thing that she was Catholic. And I just thought, so I came across the story of Geoffrey Hudson. And I thought, oh, I've got to do this. So that was kind of, you know, the Civil War came as part of the package. So I didn't really love it at the time. And I did think, oh, God, how am I going to make this interesting? But then kind of when I looked into it and I did see the people behind it, then I fall in love with it, might be a bit extreme, but I got to like it more. So, yeah, I mean, it is led by events. How can it not be when all that's going on? Basically, what I did, because the book's written in first person, you know, you'll know, anyone listening to this will know, the lead up to the Civil War is complicated. There's lots going on. There are all sorts of factions. And I knew that I couldn't put that in a book that I wanted, if I wanted people to keep turning the pages. So because I was writing in first person, what I decided was Nat would only talk about the things that affected him and that he was there for and that interested him. So that meant quite a lot of the political and religious stuff, although I have to give the background, obviously, because people have to know what's going on. You know, he's not there at all the meetings, he's not there at all the discussions. So those things are not in there. But yeah, of course the basic events have to be right. And, you know, what an incredible time. The thing that amazes me is most people, unless they did have the misfortune to do it for A-level, they don't know anything about this period, literally nothing. And I mean, spoiler alert, they kill the king.
Yeah.
people don't even know we ever killed the king.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's just amazing. So yeah, I put all that background in there. So all the Civil War stuff, obviously, you know, I hope anyway, I've made it as accurate as I could, but you won't find much in the way of battles because he's not in them. So there's none of that. But yeah, it had to be led by the events because in a way that shapes his story. That's what he kind of, his life was played out against that background. So I kind of, what I took was, if years later you were to bump into Nat in the tavern and he starts telling you his life story, which I think he probably would, these are the things he would tell you about. Mm. These are the things that mean something to him.
That's fantastic. I mean, I think that there's a problem with the way sometimes that the Civil War is taught, in that you are taught the dates of the battles, you're taught, you know, how many people were killed, who won, and then which battle they went on to next. But the people around it and the factions and the politics within what's happening with real people is infinitely more fascinating. Mm. When you see families split down the middle, cousins on one side fighting cousins on the other side because they disagree on an ideological point of interest, that then becomes incredibly fascinating. So taking what you've taken, one person's perspective on the events that are happening, is actually a great gateway in. Because if you try and sit and read a book on the Civil War and you're not the kind of person who's going to be turned on by this is the date of the battle, this is how many people were killed, then this is a great way in. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think what's nice is a lot of people have said to me the minute they finished it, they were Googling. And that's, you know, it's great if people would want to learn more about it.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
fiction can be a way into a subject.
Goodness, yeah. I mean,
it certainly works with the bloody Tudors. They get all the attention.
Yeah, I think it's time for the Stuarts to elbow the Tudors aside and have their moment in the sun.
It's so true. I mean, as someone who's interested in the 17th century and all of the stuff that was going on at the time, the immersive experience we've had over the last few years with Brexit, with the plague.
Yes.
I'm constantly looking at London and just thinking, please, nobody light a match.
Yes.
I mean, even the Dutch hate us. I mean, it's
Oh, and she's not doing herself justice, Frances, because she's actually writing a trilogy from the point of view of Barbara Villiers, and she's editing.
Oh, wow. So that sounds amazing.
Well, these are more marginalised people. So
yeah, they're interesting, aren't they? They are interesting people because you get a sideways look at history if you choose those people that are on the edge.
Yeah, a more rounded view, I think. Is there anyone that you had to bring to life for this book that you ended up thinking, God, this person's awful, I hate them? Or is it just fun, like with the Duke of Buckingham?
Yeah, it was mainly fun. I guess I don't like the king very much. I really feel like he was a bit of a twit. And I think perhaps in common with modern royalty, you know, he probably suffered from that experience of spending his whole life surrounded by people going, oh, you're really clever, sir. That's amazing, sir. What a great idea, sir. You know, that's never going to make someone a great leader, actually. A great leader needs people around them going, oh, I don't think so. Have you thought of that? And he probably never had that. And then that he was so awful to her, so awful to a 15-year-old girl. Yeah, I didn't like him. But that's not to say I didn't enjoy writing about him. I did. And in fact, in an early draft, the first draft I showed to my agent, she said, you need to make him more sympathetic or no one's going to care when he dies.
He did not know how to compromise. That was not even...
No, exactly.
Did not even occur to him that he could work with Parliament. And
also, I think, you know, he just had this very inflated idea of his own intellect. He thought he was this wily leader who could, you know, get round people, he could play them off against each other, and he was rubbish at it.
I was giving a lecture on Kaiser Wilhelm II last night and saying exactly the same.
There's a lot of it about, that's the trouble.
And this is the fun of being a historical novelist rather than being a serious non-fiction historian, is you get to have opinions on these people. So you can look at all of the available information and then say, I think Charles was a terrible pick. And you can bring that to life through your work.
Yeah, that is the joy of it, that you don't, you know, I don't have to present a different perspective on him. I don't have to be fair to him, actually. I just have to do what I would do if I met someone in real life. That's what we do. We meet people and we judge them on what we can see. And two people might come to a completely different conclusion. And in fiction, that's the fun of it. You can do that.
I think it's really interesting saying that, you know, we do look at people and judge them, when actually the central premise of the whole book
is that we shouldn't.
It's the fun of being doing historical fiction, though, isn't it? It just, you don't have to be right. But I know that when I do historical fiction, I spend a lot of time arguing with myself. And I know Charlie will do this, but I don't know if you do, Frances, where you like, this is possible, so I can put it in, but it wouldn't have happened. And then like going, just let go, you fool. It's
yeah.
Okay. And they're going, oh, but no, I can't, because it's not real. And then the other shoulder's telling you, yeah, but yeah, there's a story, just make it up.
Definitely. No, I definitely had that. I mean, there is, again, as you said, it's not a spoiler on a historical podcast to say that Villiers was assassinated. But actually, the scene just before that, I've made up. It's something that we know didn't happen, because we know the King and Queen weren't in Portsmouth that day, but I felt it's something that could have happened. If they just decided to go there, then the conversation I show, which is not with them, could have happened. The conversation between Nat and Villiers could have happened. So that was kind of my rule, really. I had things that maybe were not documented as happening, but on the basis of what is documented, feasibly might have happened. So, for example, there's a part where there's a kidnap plot against the Queen, and actually what's documented is that there was a rumour of a kidnap plot, and I've kind of taken that and run with it a bit. But there was a rumour. At that time, communications weren't great. So I felt this could have been taken a bit further. So I use that kind of creative license. I think you can't go too far because it annoys people. Mm. And I did always... I
mean, if you'd have had him, like, going to the moon...
Would have been a bit awkward. But I did...
isn't there, but I think we all stress ourselves out completely unnecessarily with where the line is.
And the funny thing is, I dreaded all along somebody saying, oh, this is not historically accurate, far more than I dreaded someone going, this is a really boring story. And that's the wrong way round.
I know. And then you sit there and you think, hang on, the Crown, the Tudors.
Yes, exactly.
About accuracy.
I mean,
the one I always thought was, what's it called? The Scottish film, Braveheart. I mean, that's completely nonsense. And, you know, and all the world...
there were no kilts and no swords.
Exactly. And all the World War II films where, you know, Britain plays a very minor part to the Americans. You just have, you do, but I agree with you, Alex. You do spend a lot of time thinking, can I? Should I? Will people hate this? And in the end, you just have to be governed by, does it make sense, and will it make someone turn the pages?
And can you stand up on the day of judgment and say, this is why I did it. This is what I had to work with. I've then taken some artistic license here. An artistic license is actually so much more interesting at the moment. I mean, the first thing that's coming to my head is the film recently about Mary, Queen of Scots, where she meets and has a conversation with Elizabeth I, which we know didn't happen.
People went nuts, didn't they?
Really
and
went
then
crazy.
Obviously all the blokes went nuts because there was a reference to a period as well.
But it was interesting, and it was great art. And, you know, Shakespeare wasn't particularly interested in the historical accuracy of his work, but it's great art. And I think that's where the historical novelists can justify themselves and sleep at night.
Yeah, and I think I do have an author's note at the end where I explain some of the things that are true and some of the things that are not. And I had that author's note in the back of my head the whole time. And I don't think it did in the end, but it was always going to begin, this is not a history book. Because it's not. You have to make an entertaining story, but give it enough historical reality that people don't feel they've been cheated.
It's a brilliant, brilliant book. It's a great romp.
Oh, thank you.
And, you know, some of the things that Nat Davey gets up to and some of the things that we see through his eyes are just incredible. I mean, he even learns to ride a horse.
Yes, he does, which I've never done. So that was quite tricky. And yeah, he has a lot of adventures, Nat. I wanted him to be quite a blokey bloke, because the title, The Smallest Man, part of that is about the fact of what is a man. You know, he has in his mind that men are big and strong and he's small and weak. And so does that make him not a man? So a lot of his struggles are to prove that he's a man like any other. So I wanted him to be quite blokey. There are times when people disrespect him, you know, he doesn't want to have a debate with them. He wants to punch them on the nose. That's who Nat is.
Amazing. Yeah, he really is. He's such a great character to spend time with. And I sort of wanted all these things for him. And it's a very satisfying book. Really, really loved it.
Thank you.
Frances, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about The Smallest Man. It is out. It is definitely available in our bookshop.
There it is.
Holding it up gloriously. And yes, buy it from us, because then not only do we take money away from Amazon, who are monsters, but we also make sure that Frances gets paid and History Hat gets a cut as well, which is
perfect.
Exciting for us, the idea of any kind of recompense for working for History Hat. so much.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great